Back in the 1950s, I wrote three serials for television about a scientist called Quatermass, who experienced some world-threatening encounters with alien life forms. Now, that decade has sometimes been called one of paranoia, which means abnormal, sick attitudes and irrational fears. Well, I don't think it was irrational to be fearful at that time. There was a lot to be frightened of. And perhaps stories like mine were a sort of controlled paranoia, inoculation against the real horrors. We'd only had a few years of peace. Britain was still rationed. Yet suddenly there was war again on the other side of the world in Korea. And by 1950, our troops had joined the conflict.
Aboard the carrier Unicorn and the cruiser Ceylon, the first contingent of British troops head for a port in southern Korea. They had left Hong Kong to music and speeches, and their arrival in Korea was warmly welcomed. The men of the Middlesex Regiment and the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders had come in response to the United Nations call for combined action against the aggressor. They had come to represent Great Britain as their colleagues in the Royal Navy had done since the Korean War began. Soon they were on their way north, to the front, to join the American and South Korean forces who up till now had borne the brunt of the land fighting. Having fought around the world from Europe to the Far East, the British soldier is never slow in settling down to unusual conditions. And the men of Britain's K Force were as adaptable as their forebears. The country they were fighting in has been described territorially as one of the worst in the world. But despite that, the job ahead of them was summed up by the private soldier who said, "It's just something we've got to do."
Then came the H-bomb, the biggest threat of all, and it soon belonged to both sides. People began to wonder, will any of us see the 1960s? My character Quatermass, of course, lived in imaginary time. But the shocks he'd endured could very well have sent him into a long, long retirement, somewhere out of it all, say in the north of Scotland. And a couple of decades later, he'd be there trying to write his memoirs.
An experiment is an operation to discover some unknown truth. It is also a risk. The Quatermass experiment, they called it. Not to give me credit, but just pinning it on me. The blame. The whole blame. For every shocking, every appalling thing that happened. And they were right.
Professor?
Quite right.
Professor Quatermass?
What is it, Marie?
A young lady to see you, sir, with a big briefcase.
Who is she?
Well, she says she wrote to you.
Well, she might have, but I've no idea. Just get rid of her.
She looks queer and faint.
All right, feed her some tea and send her packing.
I don't want your tea, Professor.
How dare you just walk in?
I want to write about you. A biography.
Oh, you're that one.
Yes, that one. You ignored my letters, so now I'm here. My car broke down and I walked.
Over the mountain, she said.
Must I go back?
Oh, Mary, make some tea. Don't you see it's an impertinence?
I'm qualified. I'm an experienced journalist. I've got 400 pages of notes about you here in my case.
It's my life.
But there's so much more I need.
Look, Miss...
Mandy, that'll do.
Mandy, then. I've been working on it myself for many years.
And? You got stuck?
Yes. Stuck. That was too much pain, I suppose.
I can help you.
Oh, think so.
The part I'm missing is the good time. Your early days before the war. You made rockets even then?
Oh, little innocent things. Toys. Tubes and gunpowder. They fell short or blew up. But I knew that if ever war came...
In the war, what did you do?
Oh, secret stuff. I won't talk about it.
Why not?
I happen to believe an oath is for life. Anyway, it helped me to set up the BERG.
British Experimental Rocket Group.
I hated the word experimental. Sounded as if we didn't know what we were doing.
But you didn't, did you?
We were working against time.
You sent three human beings up in a nuclear-powered rocket.
Tried and tested.
It went wrong.
No, it didn't. There was nothing wrong with the machine. It was the men. Those poor, wretched fellows. They were my friends. They had been my friends.
I'm sorry.
Well, it came back on me then.
Perhaps after all, I should...
No, it's too late. You'd lose your way on the mountain. Oh, don't worry. There's a spare bedroom.
I really hadn't meant...
You're going to stay and hear it all.
Bernard Quatermass was what I imagined a scientist should be. A man with a sense of awe at the sheer magnitude of what he might discover. What we often got from our scientists in the real world was a different sense of awe, a reverence before the terrible, like Dr. W.J. Penny of the UK Energy Authority, enraptured by Britain's first A-bomb blast in October 1952.
We turned round to look. The sight before our eyes was terrifying. A great greyish-black cloud being hurled thousands of feet into the air and increasing in size with astonishing rapidity. A great sandstorm suddenly sprang up over the islands. All the time, the cloud was getting higher and higher and assuming fantastic shapes as it was pulled about by the strong winds at different altitudes. It seemed ages before we heard the bang, but in fact it was only a minute.
Britain's first atomic weapon had been successfully tested.
Good morning, Mandy.
Hello, sir.
Had a good breakfast? And don't tell me you never do.
Oh, I do, but Bannocks.
Mary's pride. The birds like them. More coffee.
Thanks.
You'll need your little recorder today. I'm feeling old and words slip away. When I woke, I remembered you, but not your name. Wendy, I thought.
Oh, my God.
Oh, I got it after a while. Mandy. Almost as bad.
Amanda. I hate it.
You should have a Bible name. They're the best. Like Judith.
That's a good one.
She was my chief assistant at that time. She was actually married to that most unfortunate...
Yes, I know.
Let's make a start, then. Get your little recorder out. It really was a modest experiment. To take off from the Taruma base in Australia, perform a few orbits, and return to base.
Why weren't you there?
Huh?
In Australia, to supervise.
I had a crack team out there. I left it to them. Well, there must have been other reasons. Technical. Even political.
As things turned out, it was as well you stayed in England.
Well, I suppose so. At first, the flight seemed successful. Then the rocket went unaccountably out of orbit, and we lost all contact. We kept up a ceaseless monitoring from both bases, but there was no response.
You thought they were lost?
We tried not to, of course.
But desperate hours.
Oh, yes. 57 of them, to be exact, and 4 minutes. Then we got a trace. It was heading back towards Earth.
There's a lot in the records about how you regained control.
Oh, it was a feverish business. We soon realized we had to scrap the original plan to bring it down in the Australian desert. Well, no voice contact. Remote reversing, firing, braking. And we saw it was falling short of any open area. It was the worst possible option. Crash landing on a major city.
London.
The worst of all.
It's Raynaud.
All that smoke. Oh, it's going to go off. Come here, Len. Come here.
Shut up. It looks sort of like steam.
All that just now. Roaring flames. Oh, my God, Len. It's something dreadful. Here, come away, Len. You're out of your mind.
Here. Somebody bring the fire brigade. And the police.
Oh, Len will be done for.
Here, what do you make of this?
Never seen anything like it.
Here, keep clear. It's red hot.
It's one of them things. They finally dropped one. It's going to go off, don't you see?
It came down in southwest London, not far from Wimbledon Common. It demolished a small house, but nobody was killed.
What did people think it was?
God knows. They must have seen it was a rocket, but a lot bigger than Hitler's V-2s.
So, a nuclear warhead?
Yes, that was the great dread.
There was dread in the real world of the 1950s, yet official propaganda was still jaunty. In cinema newsreels and on television, for those who had sets, there were breezy reports on the virtues of stiff upper lip civil defense.
Back to the classrooms come thousands of grown-ups. They are the members of Britain's new Civil Defense Corps, the service that began all over again, almost from scratch, just a year ago. Since the war in Korea, more than 10,000 a month have volunteered, and the Corps' total strength is now nearly 100,000. To look in at some of their early training, our cameras went to Birmingham, where on a blitz site, the recruits, some new, some who've served before, put their lessons to practical use. Among the demonstrations was the case of the untrained civilian, and what would happen to him if an incendiary hit his home. And though as a melodrama, this may not win any acting honours, it does show for all to see that the man without civil defense training is not the ideal man about the house in emergencies like these. For though as fires go, it isn't much of a blaze, the untrained man must still call in the trained one. And that's where the firefighting recruits come in. Just one of the basic problems set to civil defense workers.
Put out of the way!
It's true there was panic.
Oh, yes, to start with. Then I managed to get our word in.
This is the BBC Light program. Before the late news summary, here is a special item. Just over 1 hour ago, a British-made rocket vehicle, the first ever to have succeeded in reaching outer space, made a safe crash landing in the area of Wimbledon Common.
We had a police escort the whole way in.
A product of the British Experimental Rocket Group, it carries a crew of 3 men. They will be unable to leave the rocket until its surface has cooled. But there is reason to suppose they are in good health.
Did you think they'd be alive?
We had no voice contact. And our monitoring of their condition was oddly incomplete.
I believe you put it down to equipment failure.
Well, what else could it be? And I saw it. A bit askew. But not a bad landing.
Then you felt some hope. For the crew?
No, I didn't dare. I just got my team through the crowd and we got busy. Listening gear, of course, measuring the hull's temperature, all the essentials.
And from inside?
Nothing. No sign of life. I remember we had a job to get people quiet. They were going mad with excitement, yelling and singing like a football match.
The scene here now is one of complete jubilation. There's a tremendous crowd coming in by car, on foot, from every direction. People are singing and cheering. I can even see some barrow boys over there cashing in. Oh, yes, and here now to pick up the story is Mr. Leonard Matthews, who lives nearby, and I believe was first on the scene, weren't you, Mr. Matthews?
Yes. Well, I've seen this great blare of light.
Len was out of the house in a flash.
Mrs. Matthews?
Not a moment's hesitation, just as he was all through the blitz. I think he ought to have a medal.
Well, I don't know.
And then we heard the tapping.
You hear it? The tapping. They're alive.
What a moment. That is, it should have been.
Oh, it was. Relief and expectancy. And the murmuring all around us while we waited till everything checked and it was safe to open the hatch. And it opened.
Professor, are you all right?
I think so. I walked close and waited for them to come out. I didn't rush in. I could have, but
There was a feel of ceremony about it, of triumph. So I waited. We all did.
Oh, God.
If you'd rather not talk about this...
No, I've lived it often enough.
Take your time.
And it almost dries my throat.
I'll have some water.
Thank you. Those three men were close colleagues and friends of mine. Reichenheim, Green, Karun. We'd worked together for several years. And now I saw this figure emerging in his spacesuit. And I recognized Victor Karun. He was swaying, very weak. So I caught him and looked for his companions. But there was no trace of them. Not of either of them. They were gone. It was the beginning of a great horror.
When I wrote the Quatermass experiment, it was to be a story about people. In science fiction, the people tend to get sidelined by the special effects. Well, back in Alexandra Palace in the early 1950s, we didn't have any special effects. The story was told through its characters, and all the better for it. It was a simple story at the start. Three men had gone up in a rocket, only one came back.
I'm sorry to trouble you, Mr. Karun.
This man's ill. He can't be interviewed.
He's a national hero, Inspector. Don't you realize that? Picture, Fred.
Whatever he's been through, he's the first man in the history of the world to have done it. Tell us.
We want to know, too.
That's enough.
What was it like?
Support him along there.
No, wait. Karun.
Cold. Cold. Help
me. Victor, I'll take him to the ambulance quickly.
Make way there. Let them through, Sergeant.
You know, that suit they wear, it is like they show in the comic magazines after all.
Poor Victor Karun. He was in a state of collapse, quite incoherent.
And the other two? No trace at all?
Not at that point. Just the empty spacesuits, lying there with their names on. Charlie Green. And Reichenheim. He'd been a refugee from the Nazis, a brilliant fellow. Between them all, they could have dealt with any emergency, I'd have sworn.
Professor Quatermass.
Go ahead.
When did you start being afraid?
I think... it was when we found the jelly. It was between the inner and outer walls of the rocket, as if it had been spun there. An organic gel in large quantities. Quantities that might account for the mass of two bodies, dreadfully altered.
No further announcement concerning the two men missing from the British rocket vehicle which landed last night on Wimbledon Common. The sole occupant, Victor Karun, is at present in hospital, recovering from shock and exhaustion.
We had some film of the takeoff. It had farewell remarks from all three. Rather jocular. Karun, most of all.
Well, this is it. I only hope I'm able to do my sums properly when the time comes. I've got a Union Jack, in case we happen to land on Mars. Now, just a word with the wife. Bye-bye, darling. Take care of yourself. And I'll do my best to bring you back something, say, meteorite for the mantelpiece. Bye-bye, darling.
So he did say that. Bring something back. Oh, my God.
By now, his temperature was impossibly low. His skin had coarsened and veined. His very bone structure seemed different.
Was he able to speak?
Oh, yes. He spoke. In German. But he knew no German.
Then how could he?
It was Reichenheim's voice. Nicht verstärken. Tun Sie nichts, zu helfen.
Don't strengthen it. Don't help it.
Looking back on it now, It was like a dreadful appeal from lost beings. All I could see then was Karun tearing at the plasma tubes in a kind of fit, and doctors fighting to save him.
Don't help it.
I totally misunderstood.
And if you hadn't, what might you have done?
Something drastic. An act of destruction. But how could I? These were my friends.
I had poor Quatermass on the edge of a new, monstrous dilemma, that you might have to kill even your own to hold off total world disaster. Forces of annihilation were being prepared that were 1,000 times more terrible than those used against Japan, perhaps enough to destroy the entire Earth, all in the hands of fallible, panicking men. Most people tried not to think about the bomb. Few succeeded. It was here to stay. Once invented, it cannot be uninvented, said the new wisdom. Think tanks appeared to think the unthinkable. Once in a while, a news item would appear about parents who killed themselves and their children to be out of it all, in spite of the official line.
People such as the Blair family of King's Heath, Birmingham, have been taught ways of dealing with the effects of the bomb. Mr. Blair, his wife, and both their daughters graduated together from their training class on the day our cameras called at Birmingham. And the chairman of the Civil Defense Committee performed a special little ceremony to mark the completion of this training course. The Blairs were presented with their badges, an alert lion that symbolizes Britain's civil defense worker.
Professor, how did Scotland Yard get involved?
Oh, one of the many confusions. Ludicrous, really. The rocket had come down in a London suburb. Two of its crew reported missing. Somehow it became a police matter.
It must have hampered your work.
On the contrary. They were most helpful, once they got some inkling of what had happened. Official statements were put out.
I've read them. All lies.
They had to be.
Did they? People got the impression that those missing men had simply never been aboard.
Yes. That was wrong.
And everything smothered up in a kind of awful optimism. Remarkable performance. Space hero Karun for a knighthood. And all the time, the poor bugger was turning into...
I know.
It's why they came after him, wasn't it?
They?
The other side. That's what they were called then. They grabbed him because they thought he had the big secret.
I suppose he had. Bigger than they guessed.
They were crude, as usual.
I'd had Karun taken to the rocket. Oh, I didn't know what I was doing. I was desperate to get him to relive the experience and try to tell us. It was hopeless. And then the crowds came. The police got us into shelter, some houses nearby. And they must have been watching. When Karun was left on his own for a few minutes, they took him.
Abducted him.
What they couldn't have known, nor did we, was that the major change had begun.
The cactus.
That's right. There had been a cactus in the house. It had become part of his hand.
Oh.
The police caught up with the kidnapped car where it had crashed, miles away. There were two dead men in it, and one out of his mind, babbling in Russian. But no Karun.
So from then on, he was like a plague carrier.
I knew he had to be found. I was getting a concept of what we might be up against. And what had taken over was a form of life that could pass through solid steel like a cosmic ray, able to destroy and change, even remake other living things.
It was the ultimate dread of the 1950s, total annihilation of all that made up our world. Not at the hands of a vengeful god, but because some fool had flicked a button.
The test was made with complete success, marking another great step forward in British Australian Defence Organisation. As 0 hour came, we were instructed either to put on thick, dark glasses or else turn our backs to the first terrific blast. I put on the glasses. The countdown began. And at zero, the eastern skyline melted into a cauldron of flame. Thick orange and golden flame, which shocked the eyes, even through the glasses, and dimmed the sun. The huge ball of flame seemed to pulsate with a deadly life, an urgent life striving to reach out far beyond itself. For a fraction, it hung that way. Then flame and smoke and dust began reaching high into the sky. A long, thin finger, then the typical mushroom shape. The whole thing seemed evil, but full of immense strength and power. Nearly 60 seconds after the first terrifying burst of flame, the sound came. A shocking kind of mind-splitting sound, like the crack of a gigantic whip. A sound that ripped its way through everything about. Then a second explosive sound, and the echoes of the blast rumbled away into the skies in waves that seemed likely to pass right across Australia.
In my story, the threat was not here on Earth ready to blow up in our faces, but out there waiting for us, drifting through space. A sort of plankton of the ether, pure energy perhaps, without organic structure. Never approaching Earth any more than a deep-sea creature comes to Piccadilly Circus. But when the rocket goes there...
Professor Quatermass, let's see if I've got it right. Instead of one man, there were the elements of three in that one body.
A sort of ghastly trinity.
So it had their combined intelligence and knowledge and experience.
Which was why we couldn't find it. We kept getting reports, most of them a waste of time, but some not. A man with a shapeless arm hiding in the darkness of a flea-pit cinema. A terrifying figure raiding a chemist's shop for deadly poisons.
But not deadly to it.
A catalyst for the final transformation. And we weren't looking for a man anymore, nothing in human shape. It could amalgamate with any form of Earth life, birds, animals, the foliage of trees.
But where you found it, of all places?
It may have dragged itself there to hide, or responded to the human element still in it and sought some sanctuary.
Westminster Abbey.
There was a television production going on there about the architecture of the place, and their cameras picked it up high above Poets' Corner, but spreading and growing every second. A mass of moving tendrils with great fungoid patches. When I saw those...
Sporangia, weren't they called?
A means to scatter spores by the billion and infect the whole Earth.
They got the army in with flamethrowers. Why couldn't they just burn it out?
It had grown too clever. It was in the whole structure, from the roof down to the crypt. It could last long enough to spread its infection, and it knew...
I used those cameras to make a broadcast. Why?
To tell people the worst. I felt they had a right to know, if there wasn't much time left. And to say who had brought it on the world.
To take the blame.
Yes.
Mike Quatermass was a man with a conscience, but even he had caused an appalling thing to happen. Throughout the 1950s, people's view of scientists was changing. Glad at first that they could protect us. Then distrust. And then fear and loathing of what they might do, driven by the pressures of the Cold War to take wild risks. Science could activate the unthinkable, and the public had to be ready to act out the unenactable.
Scenes of atomic warfare were staged at Bristol on Sunday. And though it was all make-believe, the measures taken by the city's civil defense force seemed real enough. It was assumed that an atom bomb had been dropped over the city, and the technical reconnaissance unit were among the first in the field, searching for atomic radiation. Amid the blitzed ruins of Bristol's pre-war shopping centre, civil defence workers, reinforced by troops from Southern Command, were tested by the effects of modern air war. It was Britain's first major test of how military and civilian services could cooperate in rescue work in a devastated city. Radiation meters, checking up on radioactivity, were among the equipment seen in public practice for the first time.
100 civilians had volunteered to act as casualties. And for the first time, the old bomb debris served a useful purpose, for it was supposedly the center of the atomic explosion. And from there, through the snow, the casualties were evacuated to first aid stations, where ambulance men treated wounds that had been marked with grease paint. The firemen played their role in another part of the city, in Castle Street, where a cinema was assumed to be on fire. By this time, a sharp snowstorm had added an extra trial for the defense services, giving it all an even more grimly realistic air. A bulldozer clearance of the wrecked site brought to an end Exercise Medusa, as Bristol's atom bomb test was called. But when the grease-paint wounds of battle had been wiped away, both civilians and servicemen knew that, in the words of the military chiefs, there were still many lessons to be learnt.
You went inside the Abbey alone?
Yes.
Why?
I had to. It was the last chance to speak to them, if they were still there. My three friends.
Mad?
I stood in the middle of that awful mass of growth, and I could sense within it their presence, and I pleaded for their death.
Oh, my God.
Whatever was still human there, to dissever from that evil and die. And somehow, there was a frightful sound, like a great storm.
A mighty rushing wind.
I don't know how long. At last, there was a falling about me, of an atom, whispering, rustling among the stone points. It was like nothing on earth, because it was not of the earth.
You'd won.
No, they had won.
Yes.
Which is why birds still sing in our trees these decades after. And we have plants and flowers instead of that. And now, Mary coming with our tea.
Hot bannock special for the young lady.
Oh, what a treat.
And her car is all fixed.
Must you leave?
Well, I know there's so much more.
Well, stay then. I value your comments. Some jams, homemade.
Thanks. There was a huge inquiry, wasn't there?
Oh, months of it. And drastic quarantine and all future space attempts.
Shutting the stable door.
Indeed it was. But it took me years to get started again. I changed the BERG logo, dropped the word experimental from it. Just BERG, with some very long-term plans.
To inhabit the moon.
I wrote Quatermass 2 in the mid-50s. It was a time of increasing fear. The bomb was taking the world in its grip. Its huge, terrible mystery was followed by a host of smaller mysteries. Secret airfields from which it might be delivered. Radars concealed in gigantic pods. Deep hideaways for picked survivors. But penetrating all secrets and handing our shaky defenses over to the enemy were the spies.
This is the BBC Home Service, and here is the news. The Foreign Secretary made his expected statement in Parliament today about the disappearance of the two Foreign Office officials, Mr. McLean and Mr. Burgess. Mr. Morrison said he had little to add to the Foreign Office statement of last Thursday. There had been no confirmed information of the whereabouts of the two men since they landed at St. Malo on the 26th of May. Mr. Morrison pointed out that the two men had been suspended from duty and said the question of their dismissal would depend on the result of the present inquiries. The security aspects of the case were being investigated, and it was not in the public interest to disclose them.
In America, the grotesque Senator Joe McCarthy claimed to have lists of communist agents in the government.
Well, last night I discussed the communists in the State Department. I stated that I had the names of 57 card-carrying members of the Communist Party. I noticed today that the State Department has denied that. They say they don't know of a single one in the State Department. Now, I want to tell the Secretary of State this. If he wants to call me tonight at the Utah Hotel, I'll be glad to give him the names of those 57 card-carrying communists. I don't claim to be any FBI or anything, so that when I have the names of 57, you can be right well sure there are a lot more.
His nonsense gradually fell apart. The trouble was that in Britain, we really had them, and where it mattered. Philby, Blunt, Cancross, covering each other's treachery.
Mr. Philby, Mr. McMillan, the Foreign Secretary, said there was no evidence that you were the so-called third man who allegedly tipped off Burgess and McLean. Are you satisfied with that clearance that he gave you?
Yes, I am.
Well, if there was a third man, were you in fact the third man?
No, I was not.
Do you think there was one?
No comment.
So it was against this background of secrecy and treachery that I wrote about an even darker world with even darker secrets that years later old Quatermass might be struggling to recall.
Huh? Who's that, eh? Oh, Mandy.
Sorry I woke you, sir.
For goodness sake, not sir.
Professor Quatermass.
That's better. But how did you address your tutors at university? All first names?
Well, depending on their age.
Ah, yes. Let's stick to Professor, then.
I've been running tapes, checking my notes. I've got a lot of things wrong.
Just as well you're here to get them right.
For instance, the Quatermass II rocket. Why did you call it that?
Well, it wasn't just vanity.
Well, I wouldn't have thought so.
It was Leo's idea, Leo Pugh, my first assistant. Mathematical genius, but practical as well. Give it an easy name to remember, he said, so they can toss it to each other across the boardroom tables.
To get money?
Of course. To fund the moon project.
And they shook their heads.
No, they loved it. The idea of setting up a colony on the moon. Great pressure domes for men to inhabit a world without air.
Just the little matter of shifting all the gear up there.
No problem, Prime Minister, with a small fleet of these rockets making repeated flights.
Rockets like Quatermass II? It was a death trap.
A design fault in the nuclear motor. So, end of moon project.
But you still had another prototype at your base in England.
Unsafe. Useless. Condemned.
If Quatermass had managed to get his moon project off the ground, so to speak, it would have been surrounded with the same secrecy. But where there are secrets, rumors abound about what those giant radars might really be, and lights in the sky moving too fast for any plane.
Going to manage that?
Done all I can now, sir. Theoretically, it must have struck somewhere over that way.
Well, I just hope we got some luck with this one.
Yes, sir.
It's the third, isn't it?
Since we've been here, the third, sir.
You still think you've come across one of them before?
Yes, sir. Before you joined us, sir, down south early last year, I'd swear.
Wasn't that when that big flying object scare was on?
Yeah, that's right, sir. All the newspapers full of stories. Suicides. People thinking it was the end of the world.
One of those periodic alarms, it blew over.
Things did fall.
They were all explained away.
Yes, sir.
See anything?
The sheet.
And once they got it all tidied up, they'd want to keep it that way. I suppose that accounts for those orders.
Orders? On UFOs?
Unidentified flying objects. All observations of, reports on, or public mention of, strictly forbidden. I don't want any more bonds showing their heads in the gas oven.
Sir, there's something going on. What? This next field.
What?
A woman. Seems sort of excited.
Well, let's have a look.
So that army type really put his career on the line when he came to you?
He brought a shoebox. In it were broken bits of a meteorite that had been hollow and had nearly gassed an old ploughman. Quite impossible.
But you found the man?
I did. He was deeply shocked. And for the first time I saw the mark. It was on his neck, a sort of faint, branched indentation.
Why didn't you get him to a doctor?
I tried. He fought me off. And in a pub, I heard about the lost village of Winnerdon Flats.
It was a village. 12-15 miles out on the sea. I remember going there fishing sometimes when I was a boy. I courted a girl from Winnerdon Flats. Married her. Oh, well, there was a government place there for research. Little place. A few sheds, but they seemed to content them. Until last year. And then they run mad, tore the whole village down. And they built a big place with great iron round things on top. No one let near. Guards with guns to keep them away.
I had to see for myself. I drove out there past warning signs saying, government property, keep out, danger. And finally, what I saw, I thought I was going mad.
You knew what it was?
I recognized my moon project. But it was being built right here on Earth. The huge pressure domes, everything. And by the sound, there were hundreds of men at work on it.
You must have thought somebody else had grabbed your idea.
Yes, but why? What for? What use would it be? And then I noticed on the ground all about there were broken meteorites.
And then the guards came.
That was strange, too. They ordered me away with their guns, but it was as if I didn't really matter.
Crazy.
And I fancied I saw that mark on some of their faces.
Did you go to the police?
And say, somebody's pinched my idea, Sergeant?
No. I've just been threatened by armed guards in a free country in time of peace. You could have.
I went to the company town. Hundreds of little fiberboard houses for the workmen and their families. There was a community center, a man at a desk.
We represent the workers on that project. We're doing all right. A lot more than all right. We're asked to cooperate by keeping our mouths shut. Just like in the war. We try to do our best.
Always some little man at a desk.
I went to the county police, but they wouldn't deal. I drove to London to dig up a contact that had in Scotland Yard. But he'd been moved and his successor froze at the mention of Winnerdon Flats. So then it was Whitehall and my friendly enemy, Fowler, who'd always vetted my funds. An honest man.
The place at Winnerdon Flats should be harmless enough. It's to make synthetic food. Oh, I've no personal knowledge. No. It's the responsibility of an entirely different section of the ministry, a new special section.
Synthetic food? All too plausible, what with English cuisine.
But not intended for any human consumption. That was my guess.
And nobody knew?
Oh, yes, a lot of people did, and had done for months. But they didn't talk about it. They couldn't.
They were killed?
Fowler dug out a breezy young public relations chap who'd taken whole parties to Winnerdon Flats.
Look here. You don't think anything happened to those people, do you? Good Lord, they all turned up again. Well, there's no doubt about it. One reads and hears of them. Well, there was nothing very much in operation at the time, except a sort of a pilot plant. I didn't go into it myself.
Professor, you used that wretched little man to get into the place.
He had a pass and an official car. Fowler came with us. It was like visiting my own dream. Huge pipes, steel platforms. Above all, the pressure domes 200 feet high. All like my moon project. Except that the spheres of volatile gases were not life support oxygen, but ammonia and methane.
Poison?
I'd seen all I needed. But that foolish PR man had strayed off to look for himself. We found him dying, soaked in black stinking slime. We got away only because the guards were distracted by something ridiculous. People trying to have a family picnic.
What is that? You've blown that whistle enough.
He's got a gun. Frankie.
You must not be here.
What?
It is forbidden.
I told you there'd be trouble. Them notices.
Oh, sit down, dear, and have your tea. Now, look here, mate. We come here every summer, and I don't see anyone's got a right to try and...
Go. Go now. All of you.
Yeah, don't you put that thing at my wife and my kids. We come here peaceable, like, for a picnic. We're not doing no harm to anybody or anything.
Mind, Father, perhaps you'd better go.
No.
Couldn't you have turned round and helped them?
No.
A woman with a kid.
And got shot ourselves and let the rest of the world go hang? Mandy, there were other Winnerden flats in Brazil and Sweden, as Fowler found out before he succumbed. That must be in your notes.
Yes, sorry.
I had that wretched man's jacket soaked with the filth he'd fallen in. When I got back to base, I had the stuff analyzed. It could have been synthetic food.
What?
But not for any earthly creature. For something on one of the moons of Saturn, perhaps, 800 million miles away.
I never understood that. How could they keep coming so far?
They didn't. Only from Earth orbit, a kind of artificial asteroid. Leo Pugh worked that out.
This Pugh character, your mathematical genius...
That's what he was. He found a kind of beauty in it.
The mathematical kind. The idea of making roads in space for rockets to travel... Four-dimensional roads, curved with relativity, metalled with best quality continuum.
At the village school in Marienglas, the teacher, old Miss Williams, used to set me enormous sums to do. She loved to astonish herself, but I always got them right. You'll go far, Leo Bach, she said. You have the power to benefit mankind.
How did he see this? These... whatever they were, these things...
A multiple organism, a group creature, 1,000 million individuals, if you like, with a single consciousness. The death of any one wouldn't matter.
Dedicated to the cause.
Oh, yes.
Professor, surely there was somebody you could go to. I don't know, army bosses, the government.
I tried that.
Of course you had, sorry.
Good morning, sir. And then you see a familiar mark along his hairline.
He might not.
He might.
So you turned to the press. Wasn't that a risk, too?
A different risk. I found a man with a huge popular following, Hugh Conrad. I took him to the community center at Winnerton Flats.
Hey, Ernie, look who's here.
Well, the fact of the matter is that I'm planning a new series of articles on what it's really like to work in a big modern industrial plant.
You want us to tell you about it?
I do.
It's terrific. That's what it is. The best jobs a man could ask for. Do you know what they pay here to unskilled men?
Pardon me. Haven't you noticed these?
Ah, to the devil with them.
Oh, don't be stern.
Listen, mister. We're construction workers. We're helping to build that place, but we've little enough idea how it functions.
That night, the things came in their thousands. Poor Conrad was stung by one, but he managed to get out a message.
Hello. Hello! Put me through to the night desk. Hurry! Frank... Frank, this is Conrad. Hugh Conrad. Now listen, I've got a story here. Get it, every word. Don't ask questions, just get it. For the past year, this country, and probably others, has been under the influence of... Look, Frank, you'll have to sub this to make it sound right, but... Under the influence of something from outside the earth. Yes. The things come in what appear to be meteorites. Contact with them produces violent infection. 10 minutes ago, I became the victim of one. No, Frank, I can't. I can't look. Are you getting this? Subjugation to the intention of the thing is widespread. It's given rise to the production of a protected colony at a place called Winnerden Flats. No, it's not synthetic food. It's the recreation of a world 800 million miles away. They're coming at this moment in thousands.
I told the workers the facts. How they'd been used, not infected because they didn't need to be, and worked all the better. They set off to demand answers. And all the time, the things were falling fast and being gathered.
Hear them? Things falling me out there. We want to know what they are. But what are they? That's what we've got to know.
Those are overshots. They are to do with the working of the process.
That's no sort of answer. Where do they come from?
They are harmless. They are being collected by our special squad.
As a union official, I must object to this treatment.
Special personnel, clear the gate for trucks to enter. Clear the gate. Special personnel, clear the gate for trucks to enter. Clear the gate. Clear the gate.
Caches of weapons were found and used. It turned into a battle. Men against infected men and their lies.
Attention. Normal working must be restored. Disruption must cease. The management are anxious to cooperate. Anyone injured in recent violence will be treated immediately. The canteen is also open for normal service. Unauthorized personnel now in the pressure control block, report to the canteen. All questions can be settled there. Please go to the canteen. Leave any weapons and go to the canteen. Go now. Go. Hurry, hurry, hurry.
The men weren't fooled. They used anti-tank weapons on the completed dome, and it exploded. With the gases came frightful shapes, writhing and dying. Good men died too.
But they'd won.
No, they'd lost.
How?
I'm rather tired. I'll tell you about that tomorrow.
In the real world of the 1950s, there was an actual revolution by ordinary people against their oppressors. One that seemed won, and then was lost. It happened in Hungary.
This is Hungary calling. This is Hungary calling. The last remaining station. Call to the United Nations. Early this morning, the Soviet group launched a general attack on Hungary. We are requesting you to send us immediate aid in the form of parachute troops over the Transdanubian provinces. It is possible that our broadcast will soon come to the same fate as the other Hungarian broadcasting stations. In this case, we request you to continue our call for aid to your broadcast. For the sake of God and freedom,
it may sound as if I'd used these dreadful events as a basis for my story, but I have to claim precedence, and perhaps a bit of prescience. Quatermass 2 was broadcast a whole year earlier. TV serial Quatermass 2 in 1955. That was a full year before the disastrous Hungarian uprising, but there were some curious pre-echoes. Both fiction and fact concerned revolts against oppression, ruthlessly stamped out.
The Hungarians began heroic bid for freedom with a fight for life against red oppression. When the lull came, Budapest, battered and scarred, everywhere provided evidence of the fury of the battle and of the heavy price paid for apparent victory. And now, believing that the moment of liberation had arrived, the people of Budapest gave way to celebration. We in the free world rejoiced with them, hoping against hope that Hungary had really succeeded in breaking loose from Soviet domination. News came that Russian armor was moving out of the capital. Rumbling through the streets, they were almost unheeded by the Hungarians. But in spite of promises that they would leave the country, and even while talks were in progress, they came back. The anguish of Hungary is one of the greatest tragedies of our time.
An uprising against terror horribly crushed. This was also the story of Quatermass II, and a memory still haunting old Quatermass in his long retirement.
Professor Quatermass, are you okay?
I just had rather a sleepless night, that's all. Remembering too much.
Look, if you'd rather give it a miss today...
No.
I really ought to leave you in peace. Just pack this in.
I won't hear of it.
Only if you're sure.
My dear, what's your worst nightmare?
Drowning.
Mine is to see the things that emerge from that pressure dome. Ammonids in their millions, newly nourished and combining and growing into huge, terrible shapes I can never forget.
But they all died.
They were killed by our pure air, and men died in hundreds from their poison gases. I managed to run ahead of the flow, trying not to breathe it, in desperate pain. And I found myself out on the road, still running, and there was my friend Leo Pugh. He'd come to find me, you see, in one of our trucks, gasping and spluttering from the fumes as bad as myself. And then we heard more of them arriving.
After all...
It wasn't over. Leo, I said, we've only wiped out a single nest. He said nothing. He just drove on.
Was that when you thought of using the rocket?
Yes.
It was a crazy idea, a sort of kamikaze mission.
Oh, no.
Of course it was.
I fully intended to come back.
You couldn't have. Possibly.
When we reached our base, it seemed that everything was quite normal. I ordered the rocket to be put into a state of immediate readiness, fuel tanks loaded.
Quatermass II.
With a faulty nuclear motor, the costly and explosive dud. We might still be able to give the taxpayer value. A two-man crew, myself and Leo, the only man capable of the lightning speed calculations we might need. The doctor despaired of both of us.
This is no sort of examination, the very last moment. How long were you exposed to those gases at the plant?
A few minutes.
And you're over permissible age in any case.
There's no one else to do what I have to do.
Was that when the army came?
Very fast. They took over the whole base. And in charge was the young officer who'd come with his shoebox and alerted me in the first place. Only now, he had the telltale mark on his neck.
You thought they'd stop everything?
What else?
And when they didn't?
I should have guessed, of course, but there were so many things to do. Routines I'd rehearsed and half forgotten. Pressure suits, helmets, G-bunks, checky instruments, and then...
10 seconds, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I saw the wonder of the Earth from high orbit. It should not have been for us, but for young, picked men in a glorious achievement. Not us. After about 10 hours, we locked onto the target.
Control to Quatermass. Course correct by brief calculations. You're getting beyond the range of equipment here.
Leo's calculations. But when I turned to him, I was surprised to see tears in his eyes.
Teacher, in the village school. Stand up, Leo Pugh. Leo Pugh, multiply 12,548,321 by 25 times 35. Leo Pugh, divide. Leo Pugh, multiply, divide, multiply, divide. Leo Pugh, you're a mathematical genius. Yes, Miss William. You have a brain that when you grow up will have the power to benefit mankind.
Weeping. And I knew he'd been taken.
Left! Chief!
The thing we approached was gigantic, created in some inconceivable geometry, and dreadful shapes moving about it and in it.
But you locked onto it.
I had to. That was the plan. But now it was Leo's plan. He had a gun, throwing open the hatch, ordering me outside.
What was his plan?
Their plan, I never knew. to use the rocket to tow the thing to Earth or carry them. I only knew he was pointing the gun at me, and if he fired...
The recoil, and no gravity, of course.
It swept them away, spinning so fast. When I set about doing all the things I had to do, without thinking, trying not to look only at instruments, till the nuclear stage went critical and I moved free of it. And all the time I could hear his voice in my helmet. I was safely clear when it blew. A nuclear explosion makes no sound in space. Just blinding light and all instruments crazy for a while. But I heard Leo Pugh, thousands of miles away by now, still pleading. Somehow they got me back to Earth. At least one of the Outer Hebrides. A landscape so bleak I could hardly believe. Till I heard a human voice. It said... Where's you come from, mister?
All over.
Surprisingly, it was.
What about the people who'd been affected?
It wore off. Like a sickness. Their scars healed.
Yours didn't.
Perceptive, Mandy. And true. No. My scars were a different kind. I'd looked at my own world from space. And loved it. And hated it for what it also was, full of its own dangers.
Throughout the 1950s, when I was writing the Quatermass stories, there was increasing anxiety. The bomb and the Iron Curtain left no doubt. People took up desperate public protests.
They rallied in Trafalgar Square on Good Friday. An Easter crusade, you might call it, for nuclear disarmament. This was the starting point for the four-day, 50-mile march to Aldermaston. There were several thousand marchers intent on proving the sincerity of their convictions by this public demonstration of their views. Quite a number of people, especially those with children, dropped out on the outskirts of London. The rest trudged on through the dusk. It must have been hard on feet, unused to such a walk. But the H-bomb marchers were not to be put off either by the distance or the unpleasant weather. Many were taking part in this kind of demonstration for the first time. And as they approached their destination, the Atomic Weapons Research Establishment at Aldermaston, they were joined by many more.
What did they hope to achieve? That they could melt the hearts of Iron Curtain foes? I didn't believe it. Perhaps what they were really protesting about was their own nature, the danger of being human.
Something new and ugly raises its head in Britain. In Notting Hill Gate, only a mile or two from London's West End, racial violence. An angry crowd of youths chases a Negro into a greengrocer shop, while police reinforcements are called up to check the riot, one of many that have broken out here in a few days. The injured victim, a Jamaican, is taken to safety. But the police have not been able to reach all the trouble spots so promptly, and the quietest street may flare up at any moment.
Why did you just drop out of everything?
I'd had enough.
But you must have had such authority, a unique position if you'd gone into politics.
Oh, God forbid.
Why not?
I loathe politicians. I've suffered from too many. So, I buried myself in theoretical physics.
Mistake. That's how they got you.
What?
The politicians. Professor Quatermass, you are required to attend at the Ministry of Defense.
War Office, they called it then.
Just to hear they were giving you the boot.
Well, taking me over. There was this frightful fellow called Breen. Colonel Breen of ballistic missiles.
They're setting up a permanent bases on the moon, and possibly Mars also. Is there certainty within 5 to 7 years? Those bases will be military ones. The present state of world politics leaves no doubt about that. As usual, there is a race off. Whoever plants those bases can police the Earth. Ballistic missiles will be stored there. Slave missiles. Designed to react automatically to, to activity on Earth. Even if an aggressor nation should totally wipe out a neighbor in a nuclear attack, they would themselves be obliterated by missiles from space.
He called it the dead man's deterrent. The ultimate weapon, as if there ever was one.
Why didn't you go public?
Official secrets, Mandy.
In Vienna, the conference on nuclear disarmament remains deadlocked by failure to agree an agenda. Terrorist activity in Nigeria has been responsible for 87 more deaths during the past month. Police report that Birmingham was peaceful last night after almost a week of racial disturbances. More fossil bones were found today at Knightsbridge. Dr. Matthew Roney has confirmed that they too belonged to the species he has described as the earliest known true hominid. That is the end of this news flash.
The idea of calling this press conference hasn't entirely met with official approval, has it? Now, I've made statements that these fossils are important. Now, I'll go further than that. I believe they are of unparalleled importance. They may teach us more about our remote ancestors than we've ever known. I believe they're of vast age. I believe they will show that creatures essentially resembling mankind walked upon this earth between 3 and 5 million years ago.
Dr. Roney, isn't that far further back than has been supposed?
Several times as far, yes. Up to now, the figure's been put at about 500,000 years. He had the face of an ape, but he had a big brain. And he stood like a man.
An excellent chap, Roney. What stopped him, right in the middle of all his excavations,
was what seemed to be an unexploded bomb.
A huge thing buried deep. They thought it must date from World War II. They dug very slowly.
Poor Roney.
Oh, he was desperate. Somehow he got onto me, and I involved Colonel Breen, the missile expert, just to annoy him. We went to the site. Roney's pit.
Had they got the thing clear?
Hardly started. But we could see the immense bulk of it. And then something Roney said.
About here they dug out the first skull. Well, in the earth it's been dug away, 2 or 3 feet above this level.
And it hit me. If this thing had been deeper down than the fossils, yet the fossils had been there for what? Something like 5 million years?
What did you think it was?
I tried not to guess. I watched the bomb disposal team working hard as if it really was a bomb and they were disposing of it, testing for what it was made of and getting nowhere. As they dug down, they came to a clogged up opening like the hatch of a rocket. I looked at Colonel Breen. He was intent on a rational explanation.
Perhaps. A V-weapon? Germans cooked up some pretty queer things in the war, you know. Much more than we ever knew about, I think.
Sir! Sir! There's a place here. A kind of hole.
In the 1950s, people still had vivid memories of Hitler's V-2 rockets falling on them. After the war, both America and Russia grabbed V-2s to develop them into intercontinental weapons. As late as 1956, the Astronomer Royal declared the idea of space travel was bilge. But a year afterwards...
The Russians have won the space race. Scientists announced today that a satellite was successfully launched into Earth orbit at the first attempt. Its name is Sputnik, and its confident blips are being received clearly in Britain and around the world.
Yes, signals from the Russian satellite, the Red Moon, the news of whose launching burst on the world like a bolt from the blue. Staggering news, for we in the West had expected that the United States would be the first to launch a satellite. Well, now the Russians have done it. They've done it first, and they've done it with complete success. The Soviet satellite is said to be about 10 times as heavy as America's projected moon, and it circles the Earth every 95 minutes. Over 500 miles up at a speed of 18,000 miles an hour.
So Breen was trying to fit this into his mindset.
Desperately. Even when they found a third skull right inside it.
Another one.
Oh, go gently with it. They're so fragile.
There's another skull. Look. Careful.
Let me go. Yes. Yes, it is one. Let me do this, please. Barbara, get the things. It's almost out. Quick! Oh, magnificent. Beauty. Found nothing like this. It's almost intact. Here, Barbara, you take it a moment.
Intact?
Captain Potter, if you strike anything else, let me know at once.
I'll take it.
pure chance it wasn't smashed. It must have been forced in there.
But surely, such a huge unexploded bomb, there'd be some kind of official record.
Nothing. Oh, I saw one house just above the pit that looked badly wrecked. But a policeman told me it had been like that long before the war.
Us kids used to run and touch that front door just for days. You know, there were all sorts of tales. That noise is being heard. Bangs and bumps. Even things being seen.
And then an old neighbour.
Dreadful sounds. People couldn't stop in the ash with them. They had to go. Terrified. There was a sort of tapping and knocking. Just like some person wanting to come in. Only there wasn't nobody there. In the floors it come, and in the walls. We could hear it. And you feel quite queer. Sick. And things that move about all by themselves in rooms that had nobody in them. It's a fact.
But Colonel Breen was intent on his V-weapon. He got the whole thing carefully emptied, yet there was no sign of any mechanism. Just this great hull, made of some kind of ceramic, totally heat-proof. And then when one of the bomb team was working inside...
It was a kind of figure. It went through the wall.
The Hobbs Lane ghost, they called it. I tracked down accounts of hideous goblins there in 1762. Imps and demons sent by the devil, 1341. And in the days of the Romans.
Did you tell Breen?
He wasn't listening. He'd found the warhead.
Oh, no.
He got them drilling it open. Dreadful. Wild noises that sent us all staggering about, numbed. Then the bulkhead knotted. And we saw giant insects, half as big as a man. Three of them. And just for a moment. But they were dead. They'd been dead for a long time.
When I wrote the Quatermass stories, I couldn't help drawing on the forces and the fears that affected people in the 1950s. The last adventure, the one I called Quatermass and the Pit, went way beyond concerns of the time and into an ancient diabolical race memory. It sought to explain man's savagery and intolerance by way of images that had been throbbing away in the human brain since it first developed. Racial unrest, violence, and purges were certainly with us in the 50s, and I tried to speculate on where they first came from. For old Quatermass in his latter days, this brings the most terrifying memory of all.
Mandy, have you ever smelt a crab in an advanced state of decay?
A crab? No, can't say I have.
That was the stink of those dead creatures in the hull.
If they'd been decomposing for millions of years...
They hadn't. Only the last few minutes. They'd been in a sealed, sterile chamber till our dirty London air got in, and then... Phew.
Made up for lost time.
That smell. Did I say crabs? It was far worse. It was the stench of evil.
How do you mean?
Evil, Mandy. That's what it really was.
I soon found out.
There seem to be legs. Three of them. It's a tripod. It's a strange formation. Antenna like a beetle's. Where's that girl? Look out for her, will you?
What are they? How did you get hold of them?
No questions now. Get those boxes ready. How is that one?
Not good.
Well, if you can just try to save the horny shell. Look, try to keep the body fluids separate and correctly described.
And your friend, Colonel Breen, what did he think?
He'd stop thinking.
Of course he would.
He clapped the whole place under an army ban. But the story was out.
Monster insects. Get your gazette, thank you. Monster insects found. Get your gazette. Read all about it. They got them in there now in the museum. You can't get in, but you can read all about it. Gazette.
Roney's team did a remarkable job to switch from digging out fossils that at least were fairly clean to preserving those rotting things from the hull.
How many of each? The ape skeletons?
They were scattered. Six or seven.
And three of the others? All in there together?
You're jumping the gun.
Weren't they?
Well, it's what I thought too. I studied the face, if you could call it a face, of the insectile thing in Roney's lab. It had round eyes that seemed to look right into the back of my own and find something there that it knew. Oh, I shivered, and I went to find Roney.
You know, I think these are old friends that we haven't seen for a long time. Perhaps the world that's dead now, but a few million years ago, could have been teeming with life. It's a funny word. Worn out before anything turned up to claim it. Martian.
And that Martian, he got to you even when he was dead.
That's when I was sure about the...
Dead now, but a few million years ago could have been teeming with life. The funny word. Worn out before anything turned up to claim it. Martian.
And that Martian, he got to you even when he was dead.
That's when I was sure about the evil. I thought, suppose 5 million years ago, there were living beings on Mars with all kinds of advanced techniques, which enabled them to visit Earth at a time when our own ancestors were only a kind of ape. And then they found Mars was doomed.
What could have done it?
Take your pick. Global warming, greenhouse effect, or something less fashionable. Say, the loss of its atmosphere.
They could have colonized Earth, but...
Big but. The strong oxygen. The bacteria.
That's why they were sealed in.
Now another big but. Suppose they possessed biological techniques to alter genetic material.
Take apes to Mars and change them. Boost their intelligence.
Return them to set up a colony.
Better than nothing.
A lot better.
But wait a minute. You said evil. What's evil about wanting your civilization to survive? I think it's rather noble.
So did I, at first.
Did you try it on the others?
Moroni bought it straight away. That we come on a single incident, a landing that went wrong, and they all died. But then, at the War Office...
You realize what you're implying? That we owe our human condition to the intervention of... insects? Breen, do you accept any of this?
No. No, I don't. Not a single word. Kratom, as you asked me a while ago, if I had a theory of my own... Well, I have, and here it is. And it does not involve Martians or obscene experiments.
Go on, please.
Only Germans. And it goes back to 1944. Once the Germans realized they were losing the war, they put out a propaganda scare. They sent over an experimental V-weapon that would produce exactly the effect it has produced, thanks to you. Except that it was a little late for that purpose.
But that very night, common sense took a knock. The drill operator, a man called Sladen, went back to pick up some tools. The whole excavation came alive around him. Planks flew in the air, cables lashed like snakes. We followed his trail later, all over West London. We heard about the dreadful sounds that accompanied him. People said he was not like a man.
What, then?
He finally took refuge in a churchyard.
The vicar saw the ground move beneath him, rippling.
We were having a choir practice here tonight, and I happened to go out for a breath of fresh air, and I saw him. He was lying on the path. He was in evident terror. It occurred to me that he looked as if he was seeking sanctuary. So I called Mr. Edwards, our choirmaster, and together we brought him in here. He was quite exhausted, but agitated in a dreadful way. When I saw those and heard those sounds, I asked Mr. Edwards to go to dismiss the choir. I knew I had to stay with this man. I was sure that he'd been in contact with spiritual evil.
Well, that's what a vicar would say.
I said it too when I saw Sladen. A decent, friendly man finding himself, for minutes at a time, another creature in an unrecognizable world.
Did he have a name for it?
No.
You hadn't prompted him?
It was just pure terror. He'd lost himself and was one of them, leaping and hopping as they did.
I remember. It started, and then I couldn't see anything but them. Like you took out of the hole, with the eyes and the horns.
We saw the creatures.
And they were alive.
Alive?
I've been running hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. You know, I was one.
The rat?
Jumping, leaping.
Leave him alone. Where?
In and out. Them big places. In and out of them. Huge. Right up into the sky.
Through him, we were getting a vision of life on ancient Mars. The man was possessed. And so very nearly were we others. We could feel it there, in the church vestry.
There must have been some hidden mechanism in the hull that could trigger these feelings.
No, it was the very substance of it. I remember, it looked as if it had been cast with perfect precision out of some kind of unshatterable porcelain.
They tested it?
Of course. What baffled them was its coldness. Touch it, and it seemed to draw your body heat. I was sure it was infinitely dangerous.
What you really needed was time.
Months, at least. I had hours. Oh, and then, a really wild one. I remembered Roney's optic encephalograph.
The optic encephalograph. I was rather pleased with this machine. I credited the polymath Roney with having invented it in his spare time. What it really resembled was a virtual reality set clamped about the head. But instead of projecting synthetic images into the brain, it drew images out from the brain's own vision centers. Not a bad guess for the 1950s, though it seemed to go a bit far at the time. Good for Roney.
By dawn, I set up a test. I used myself as the subject, but got only a frightening confusion. No, it was Roney's assistant, a young woman who proved to be the one.
That was Barbara Judd. I've seen her name in my notes.
Oh, she was bright, about your age. She went inside the hull with that apparatus on her, and it all went mad.
Oh, God! Oh, God!
It continued for some time.
It could have killed her.
It's possible.
Why didn't you stop?
I had to do it. Anyway, she survived.
You were lucky.
I got the recording.
What do you claim it shows?
The wild hunt.
The what?
The wild hunt. It appears in legends the world over, the phantom ride of witches or devils.
Really, gentlemen.
Roney and I told him that was the legend. The awful fact behind it was on the tape. A race purge. A cleansing of the Martian hides. Blotchy, subjective as the images had to be, there was no mistaking the fury in them. Those creatures were killing each other in what may have been a ritual slaughter.
Termites and wasps, don't they do something like that?
To get rid of mutations, preserve a fixed society. And this was the image stored in the hull.
Did they buy it?
Did they?
We are looking for rational explanations. I think there is one. Dr. Roney, this truly amazing apparatus of yours was designed to detect, was it not, hallucination
Well, originally, yes, but we've advanced...
Hallucination. Exactly, sir, I think you've hit it.
What? Yes, nothing else.
Let's call it a mental image.
Lady clearly has imagination, and she's overwrought.
So, no dice.
They opened up the pit that night. Floodlights were trained on the hull for the TV cameras. Colonel Breen said his piece.
The West German federal government has agreed to institute new searches of existing wartime material in order to assist in identifying the machine. Thank you.
Copies of the statement here.
A live cable had been dropped. The hull drank a huge charge of electric power. I saw it begin to glow. Inside, then from end to end. I ran with all the rest. It was pure, mindless panic.
Did you know what was happening?
Oh, I don't think I knew anything any longer. The worst of it all was the dreadful sense that we were not human. More and more joining in from everywhere like a great tide. It was Roni who saved me. He found me and took me back into myself. That was hard.
He wasn't affected.
One of the few. All around us, a screaming, maddened city.
Flash. Latest reports on the amazing and still unexplained paralysis of London, England. In the past hour, it seems to have spread to outlying districts. Power breakdowns have plunged vast areas of the city into total darkness, and all contact with the rest of the country has been broken. Planes have been diverted from London Airport. However, we are now going to try to get an eyewitness account by boosted radio link from a U.S. freighter now over the stricken city. Go ahead, pilot. Go ahead, pilot.
Hello? Hello? I'm over central London at this moment, but it's completely unrecognizable, all blacked out, except for those fires down there. Same as in World War II. I can still see lighted areas up beyond. They must be 20 or 30 miles away, though. Hey, one of them just blacked out, a whole great patch. You see that, Joe? I guess that means it's still spreading, whatever it is. Now there's something right ahead. Look at that, will you? I don't know what this is, but it doesn't seem like a fire. Hey, Joe, take over for a second. There's something. What's the matter with you? I said take over.
Professor, what was the word you used? The hull sublimated?
Yes. Yes. The entire hull melted into a sort of vast fireball, hovering, vibrating above the pit. The shape it took on was like those Martian insects, but enormous. The Horned Devil. Setting people against people, killing and burning in every street, turning London into a purged Martian colony. 5 million years too late.
You said some were immune.
Like Roni. I wanted to kill him, you know. Oh, God, if I had.
Ever study legends? Then you'd know the devil's traditional enemies, iron and water. Legends gave us the first clue in this business that may be worth trying again. It was possible to fling a mass of steel cable through the middle of it, connected to wet earth. That might make sense, both magical and scientific.
He proved it. He did it. And he died in doing it. His kind had outgrown the Martian in us. But for the rest, every war crisis, witch hunt, race riot, purge, is a reminder and warning.
That we are the Martians now.
To look at you, my dear. But it's true. If we can't control the inheritance within us, this will be the second dead planet.
It could happen when we'd killed enough of each other.
Whole populations.
And poisoned the earth and the air and sea. It would be time to move on again, wouldn't it?
For the survivors.
Where?
Maybe to Alpha Centauri. And set up camp there, if they could.
And if they couldn't?
Well, they might manage to pass something on among the natives.
Once again.
Mandy.
I think I hate us.
Thank you, Mary.
Oh, wished away.
Mary promises us a great Scots supper tonight.
Haggis?
No haggis at all. Roasted capercailzie, buttered sea kale, and rowan jelly. You're off in the morn?
Yes. Professor, I'll try to send you a draft, if I can.
I might come to London.
No, don't. Not after this place. You've no idea. It's all gangs, dead bodies in the streets, Hyde Park a shanty town. Everything broken. You were right. We are the Martians.